In this episode, I chat with Andy Raskin, the founder of Strategic Narrative. Andy helps CEOs and their leadership teams aligned around a high-level story that powers success. In the episode, we'll analyze the best pitch deck ever, explore how to implement a strategic narrative, learn key lessons from Andy's experiences working with over 100 companies. Plus, we'll discuss how to get your team aligned and fully engaged in crafting a narrative that truly resonates. All right, guys, let's do it. Hey, Andy, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Todd.
Yeah, pleasure is all mine. Well, maybe we can start off with a somewhat philosophical question. Who is Andy Raskin? And feel free to answer that however you like.
Well, if I tried to explain my career path, I don't think we'd have time in this podcast to try to make sense of it. But for about the last 10 years, I've been working with CEOs on what I call strategic narrative, which is this one story that they're telling about the world and about their buyer that powers success, sales, marketing, fundraising, product development becomes the North Star for that, recruiting, everything. So I really look at this story as, like I said, strategic narrative, that it is the strategy of the company, which is, of course, why it is a CEO, job to do that. I typically work with B2B kind of enterprise SaaS companies that have large sales forces. But I've written some posts over the years that others also tell me have been really valuable for them around the sort of same concepts.
Yeah, got it. Thank you. And what is the kind of the pain point that they're experiencing when they bring you on board? Why do people typically bring you on board?
Essentially, I just made a LinkedIn post where I listed out. So every time a CEO contacts me, we have a conversation, and if it gets to the point of me, sending out a proposal like an SOW, I'll write down what did they say is they're looking for, and I think there's a few variations on it. One is this. I think the biggest thing is alignment. Hey, we're growing. Early on, one CEO said this, it was kind of brute force of the founders. We were successful, but it was sort of all over. And now we're getting bigger and we're going to have to all speak with one voice, all sing the same tune. And I want one story that's going to guide all of that. I'd say that's really the main thing. But it happens at different stages. Sometimes it's, they're going from Series A to around Series B, sort of that stage. It happens later. So some companies I've worked with where they're either building or acquiring lots of new products. So they've had success in one area and they're starting to branch out into other stuff. We've kind of spoken with this one story. It's worked well, but now we're going to need this bigger one that's going to, kind of make sense of why we have this bigger offering and help us sell that all the rest. Some people think about it as I want to create a category. I don't usually use that category language, but I do because just people use it. But they'll say hey, we kind of came up with a category name we like these three words that we thought, we're going to kind of just convey to the world, why we're so great and different. And I don't know, just those three words aren't working. We need a story around it. And even, if the category people, the play bigger people and stuff will say hey, the core part of this category thing is this story, namely about a shift in the world. And so sometimes it's that. And I'd say maybe the last thing is where they are. They've actually, those are the biggies. Maybe I'll just stop there.
Yeah, gotcha. No problem. You can expand on that later. Listen, I mean, you have a whole framework for how to approach a strategic narrative. And that's kind of the meat of this podcast episode. So we're definitely going to go deep on that. But you also talk about superiority claims. And this is kind of an alternative to superiority claims. Maybe you can just kind of expand on that point and explain what you mean.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the history of kind of messaging, at least it starts to get codified around the 70s and 80s around this concept of like positioning, and you have this book, Crossing the Chasm. And, you know, Crossing the Chasm, really the main advice of Crossing the Chasm is you're going to create this claim of superiority that you're going to just say everywhere. I call this the arrogant doctor. So this is the basic approach is, hey, you have a problem. We have the solution. Let me tell you why it's the best solution for you, your type of buyer, whatever. And on the face of it, it kind of sounds like it's customer focused because we're talking about their problem. But really what it sets us up to do is just sort of brag about ourselves all the time, right? We're better for this. We're better because of this, this, this. And I think that approach, you know, like I said, that it comes from an age when products were very simple. They didn't change much. You know, cans of soup on the shelf in a supermarket, cars in a dealership, even software back then, you know, sold in shrink wrap boxes that sit on a shelf and maybe get updated once a year. But now, especially in the SaaS, you know, we're in a world where the product is changing literally minute by minute sometimes. The markets are very, very crowded. So buyers being bombarded by these claims. And, you know, can you even create the identity of a company on product claims when the product itself is so dynamic and the landscape is so dynamic? And so what I started seeing was that there was this other approach. I started seeing it over like 20 years, well, maybe 15 years, until I sort of started codifying it, that there was this other approach that I called strategic narrative. And that approach is the starting point is not you have a problem, I have the solution. The starting point is, hey, there's been a big change in the world, in your world as a buyer.
Yeah, but maybe we can, and just before we jump in, because that's what you really want to talk about, is because you wrote a blog article on Medium, which was the greatest sales deck I've ever seen. And that kind of outlines the different parts to this framework, if we want to call it a framework. But just to kind of zoom out for a second, and I think, correct me if I'm wrong, the way when I was researching this podcast and I was thinking about, you know, humans, it's intrinsically in our DNA to tell stories, right? That's how we've been able to evolve from, you know, a group of 150, you know, monkeys into huge groups of people. And in the book Sapiens, Yuval Noah Harari said, you could never convince a monkey to give you a banana by promising limitless bananas after death in monkey heaven. I think basically what I'm trying to make this point here is that, yeah, stories are in our DNA. It's what the connective tissue that holds everything together. Do you feel like you've just taken the power of storytelling and just kind of overlaid it and applied it to a business concept? And that's potentially why it's so impactful.
Yeah. Although, you know, the storytelling thing, like, you know, it comes from the world of movies. And, you know, we're not building a three-act screenplay here. So what applies, what doesn't apply? I actually, it's interesting you say that. So the way I really got into this was I started as a software developer myself. And a friend and I had an idea for an app. This was like .com years, so like Windows app. So we coded it, a little prototype. We got some users. We were already living in the Bay Area. We're like, okay, maybe we could get some investment. We decided of the two of us, I spoke English, so I should fluently. So I should write the plan. So I wrote a plan. We sent it to some VCs and the reaction was really bad. And one of them wrote back like, Andy, listen, I rate every plan I get on a scale of 1 to 10 and yours is a 1. And then he wrote in parentheses worst in case we thought maybe 1 might be the top of his rating scale. But then he wrote in the margin, he wrote not a compelling story. And I didn't really pay much attention to that. We were just sort of really down about the rejections. But a few weeks later, I was walking by this Barnes & Noble in Manhattan where I lived. And actually, I guess I still lived in Manhattan at the time. And there was a sign in the window and it said, for anyone who wants to tell a compelling story. And okay, that was me. And there was an arrow pointing to these books that turned out to be screenwriting books. And I read these books and, they suggested a very different way of structuring a pitch. Well, first of all, just this idea that a movie is a pitch. I think I got from these things. Like, what is Star Wars a pitch for? It's a pitch for, like, ultimately, like, trust the Force, like, be good, you know, have friends and be nice to people. But like I said, I was pitching a business in a very short amount of time with no graphics or anything. Like, what applied, what didn't apply? I started asking those questions, and what I came to when I saw that Zwora deck that you referred to, and that's the deck in that post, the greatest sales deck I've ever seen. That's where it all really clicked for me. I had been kind of working on it for years and posting about it already, but that's where it all really clicked into place for me.
Well, maybe you can explain the story then, the genesis of that deck. How did it come about? Why did you write that article? Yeah, what's the backstory?
Well, why I wrote it is because I've been thinking about these questions for a long time, and it really helped me articulate, like you said, a framework for how I would think about this, how I was thinking about it, how I wanted to think about it. There are really five pieces to it. The first, you know, Zwora comes out of Salesforce, and the founder of Zwora, Tien Suo, was like number 11 at Salesforce. And if you look at their pitches, it wasn't, hey, you have a problem where you have to repeat the bill. So the Zwora's called themselves a subscription billing platform, and there were already a bunch of them, and they were basically saying that, like, that arrogant doctor, hey, you have a problem, you have to, like, you know, most billing software is only gonna, like, send one bill, and how are you gonna repeat the bill, and how are you gonna do that? And Zwora starts in a fundamentally different place. They say, hey, we now live in a subscription economy. They say, hey, the world has changed. It used to be transactions, like we would buy things one-off. Now we're living in this new world already, not its future, but already, where we're subscribing to things. And this was early. This was, I think, like 2014, 15, they started doing this. You know, we have Netflix, we have Uber, which is sort of subscription-like, instead of versus like buying a car. Not everything is transactional. Even now, not everything is transactional. Probably the minority of things are subscription, but they pose this very absolute shift in the world. And then the whole rest of the pitch is like, well, how are we going to deal with this? The second piece of it is...
Sorry to interrupt, yeah. Andy, because I think this is super interesting. I guess what that does is it... Instead of, I mean, even speaking of ourselves, even in my own pitch presentations, I do think we indeed start with the problem. And I'm sure a lot of people, you know, listening to this will do exactly the same thing. So instead of talking about the problem and then your solution and why yours is superior, well, I guess what you're doing is you're kind of saying, well, the world has changed. You're already behind. So you've set the expectation, and they're already, shit, we're behind. Yeah. I guess that's important. Part of this,
yeah, it's a because and you're getting to the second piece of it, which is what I call really naming the stakes, because and again, there's a very illustrative thing that happens in Star Wars and happens in almost every movie. So sorry for the Star Wars spoilers for anyone who hasn't seen it. It's been like 40 years, so hopefully that's not a big deal. You haven't seen it, you're probably not seeing it. But in the first one, you know, the first one that came out, A New Hope, Luke has been bellyaching for the first 15 minutes. Like, I want to get out into space. I want to have adventures. You know, I want to be a pilot. So, you know, Obi-Wan shows up. He's like, hey, I got this mission for us. Let's go into space. I'll teach you to be a pilot, all this stuff. What does Luke say? He says, you know what? It's getting kind of late. I got to go home. Sorry, I can't get involved. Who does this sound like? Todd.
It sounds like a prospect.
The reluctant prospect, right? And, you know, people say, like, you should make the pitch emotional or make the story or whatever. And I always found that weird because, like, what does that even mean? Like, literally, what is that? How do we define that? And here's how I define it is it's not emotional if the person does not see stakes for themselves. Like, so Luke in that situation, he's saying, I'm not going to do this because he basically sees the future as okay. You know, maybe there will be ups and downs, but, you know, he doesn't see it being too bad. What happens and then what does George Lucas do to create the stakes? The Empire kills, again, sorry for the spoilers, the Empire kills Luke's aunt and uncle. Now Luke's kind of understands, like, well, probably they're coming for him. And as an audience, we understand, like, well, probably he's going to be dead. Then Obi-Wan has this other, laying out this other path where that he might thrive and win. And so now the future is different. It's bifurcated into a likely, like, and you said, you're already behind and you're going to probably be dead. Or this other path where, you know, look who's thriving. So what Zwora did is they said, hey, listen, there's been kind of this accelerated die-off of companies. They show this stat about how, like, the Fortune 500 companies are sort of around for shorter and shorter times. But look who's thriving. Oh, it's the companies that are adopting, like, subscription and subscription-like models, like, you know, all these examples. And this is what it's setting up. It's exactly the same thing. And it is kind of to what you're saying. Like, hey, I mean, we don't want to say, like, you're behind. Like, it's just like an insult, right? Like, we don't want to trigger that. So it's a little bit sensitive. I've written about this a little bit. Sometimes we want to say, like, hey, I was in that situation too. You know, we were there too. And this is what happened to us. So there's a little bit of kind of like empathy there. And we're not just saying, hey, you're an idiot because you haven't shifted. But if we do it properly, I think it's really works well. And what the other thing that it's super great for is discovery. So usually discovery is, hey, I'm going to ask you questions about your pain. But if we're talking, hey, there's a shift in the world, we're seeing this happen, how's this playing out for you? We can start hearing some real gold around this.
Yeah, that's super interesting. So number one is name a big relevant change in the world. Then we have to create stakes, so show there'll be winners and losers. And then the third step is to tease the promised land.
Yeah, so I've actually updated the way I talk about this. And when I say tease the promised land, it used to be people would basically just sort of say, like, oh, so I just have to describe, like, how great it's going to be once, you know, they're going to be making a lot of money. And it was just too vague and stuff. What I now call it is the buyer mission statement. So we're going to put out, so in this new world, the way I talk about the shift in the world now, too, has evolved. I call it the shift from an old game to a new game. So in the Zwora case, the old game was, you know, transactions, the rules of that game are you sell something and someone buys it and you sort of have, that's it. Maybe you sell them again something, but maybe not. And the game changed to basically how do you keep this person on for life. And that game has a different kind of object of the game. You know, every board game you play has an object of the game. What is the object of this new game that's different? So for Zwora, they went through a bunch of iterations. One iteration was very simply turn customers into subscribers. You know, very simple. Very comes right from it, right? Doesn't have to. And I like this to be simple. I like it also to be in this second person command form, so that it acts as a rallying cry. What I really think we're doing here with the strategic narrative is turning the company and the product, or kind of enveloping them all in a movement. Category people call it, may say, as a category. I like thinking about it as a movement, because it really is what it is. Like, we're championing this shift, this change, not just a kind of like new type of thing. The new type of thing will follow, right? You know, if you look at Airbnb, when they were early on, if you went to their website, it said live there. This live there, to me, is a buyer mission statement. And the buyer mission statement often works really well as that like top line of the website, because it explains all the differentiation, not in terms of a claim of superiority, but in terms of a different goal state for the buyer. So, you know, we're Airbnb not saying like, oh, we're cheaper than hotels, or I don't know if they are, but or we're more convenient or whatever. They're saying, hey, there's this other goal state that we're, everything we do is designed to get you there. So this third piece, I used to call it the promised land message, or tease the promised land. That's fine if that works for you. Lately, I always call it, so name the object of the new game, or what I call this buyer mission statement.
Gotcha. And then I guess say another huge mistake the companies make, particularly in SaaS as well, is they talk about all the bells and whistles and the features themselves. Whereas your fourth step is to introduce features as, again, apologies if you've changed the wording on this, but introduce the features as magic gifts for overcoming obstacles to the promised land. So you've kind of communicated the promised land, this different state, but now you're talking about your features and your product in a way that essentially helps them get there.
Yeah. I mean, there's this knock on talking about speeds and feeds. And speeds and feeds are very, very important. By this, I basically mean features, right? And especially when we're in a very technical product, you know, these things are really matter to people. What we've done, though, by first setting up these first three pieces, is we created a context on why these features are going to be life and death. So the fourth piece is, before we get to the magic gifts and the features, we're saying, okay, you want to live there? Well, there's going to be some obstacles to living there. And Airbnb doesn't do this because they're not selling in a sort of enterprise situation, but just imagine they were. Say, well, you know, how are you going to be, you know, let's take actually the Zwora example instead. So you want to turn customers into subscribers. And let's say they're pitching like Ford, which is actually the company they were pitching in the sales deck that I got. So now I say, okay, you want to turn customers into subscribers. Well, in this new world, like, how are you going to know the preferences over time of the people you're gonna, you know, gonna, because you want to have this always on relationship with them. You know, to make this work, you're gonna have to track those things. How are you going to have different like pricing tiers, and, you know, change those often, and communicate change, all this stuff. There's all these like obstacles, and you can really think about this as, in the movie situation, because we've been talking about that, you know, in Star Wars or Lord of the Rings, whatever you want to call it, the character can't just go and accomplish their mission. Like, there's things in the way. And same thing here, like, if they could, if turning customers into subscribers was just really easy, like, there's no reason for Zwar to be there. So it must be hard. So we're going to start with, well, I do it into a bunch of how will you questions, like, how are you going to know their preferences? How are you going to track their lifetime value and segment the highest customer? How you can do all these things, right? And then, of course, this sets us up for now talking about all these features, as this sets up the features that Zwora offers as kind of like the lightsaber, you know, and the Jedi mind tricks that Obi-Wan is going to teach Luke. These are what the screenwriting people call the magic gifts that the main character gets. And now they're not just they're not just solutions to disembodied problems. I mean, because you could think of it as like, oh, yeah, that's just problem and solution. The thing is, what we've set it up as, you're solving these problems in order to reach a goal state that has life and death consequences for the company, right? And so that setting up that context around it is, I think, what makes where the magic happens.
Yeah, it's super interesting. And then I guess the final step, which I guess is really critical, is you then have to provide some evidence or proof that you've done this before, and you can guide them on that process. You can help them with those obstacles, and you can help them achieve that state.
Yeah, I mean, we clearly want to show that there's some reason we're not just making this up. And then, you know, there's many ways to do that, and how you do that probably also depends on the stage of your company. So if you're, you know, a very mature company, you probably have lots of success stories you can talk to, and you can probably even target them by different, you know, what industry they're in or what segment they are, and sort of pull a success story that matches them. You're just starting out. You may have like close to nothing like that. And the only thing you can talk about is like, I don't know, our team, or, you know, like an investor pitch, or, you know, I don't know, some prototype we made and some traction it got, you know, we'll take what we can get, but whatever we can, you know, yeah, really nice to have that.
So this, I can imagine this being to guide a company through this framework and this process, because you work specifically with CEOs, right? So, and in big companies, you work with some really, really big, well-known SaaS companies. I can imagine to implement this framework to get everybody on board, to get everybody aligned, must be really, really challenging. Now, I'm not expecting you to give away any kind of secret sauce here, how do you kind of go about that process? And I know that's probably a really, really big question with a huge answer, but you know, what are some of the steps you have to go through?
I think on LinkedIn, I've given away pretty much all the secret sauce, so I don't know if there's any like awesome, like dips of it left. But I'll share maybe a few things. You said I work with CEOs, and that is true. I do see the CEO as, like I said earlier, like if you really do believe that this story is the strategy of the company, how can this be delegated to marketing? How can this be, you know, anything other than a CEO job? And that said, the CEO has a huge task in, you know, aligning the team around it, getting people to buy in. And so to balance that, I ask the CEO to create a small team. I call it strategic narrative team, which is themselves and up to four other people. And typically these are heads of sales, marketing, product. So marketing does have a big role, is not the leadership role in my, and this is controversial. I just got an email from a very well-known marketer. He's like, hey, thinking of doing a strategic narrative. Really want to talk to you. And I sent an email back like, hey, great. But the CEO plays this sort of central leadership role. So I'd ask that your CEO join the call and maybe read a couple of my posts beforehand. That was yesterday. I haven't heard back. So
I'm really super intrigued. Did you start off not, you know, with head of marketing, and then you quickly learned that it had to be the CEO, or do you always have that stance?
Great question. In the first few years that I did this, it was mixed. Like I basically would just, I would be open to working with whoever contacted me. Sometimes it was the CEO, sometimes it was the marketing leader, sometimes it was other, like someone else. Head of customer success, I think was early on. And I looked back at after a few years, and I was like, which are the ones here that were like the really successful ones where it took hold and all the rest. And every time it was so clear. It was where the CEO was the leader. And eventually I decided to just insist on that.
Yeah. Yeah, gotcha. So you've worked with, correct me if I'm wrong, more than 100 companies implementing this framework. You must have learned a heck of a lot. what are some of the? I think you actually wrote a blog article about this somewhere. But what are some of the key lessons you've learned with working more than 100 companies in this area?
Well, one of the lessons that I think maybe is like the biggest one. It's kind of we've been talking about it a little bit, but that conversations about messaging are really conversations about strategy. I think we tend to think of strategy as this very, I don't know, like academic thing, and that if you ask different people in the company, well, how do you define strategy? You know, if you ask people who have been to business school, they say, you have to define Porter's five forces, which I don't know if you know, there was this famous book about strategy. And you do this presentation where you write about you figure out your stance on the five forces and how they apply to you. If you talk to people in marketing, it'll be some internal messaging positioning document that is supposed to be the source of truth for everything. If you talk to, leadership kind of people, it's like we have a mission statement and a vision statement. That's the strat, right? And I thought really hard about this when I started doing this work. Like, what is the instrument that we're going to use to define the, like, how does the strategic narrative relate to all of those things? And where I came to is that what's the mission of the company? It's that buyer mission statement. You know, if we want to be a customer focused, what is the goal state we want to put out there for the buyer? That isn't that the mission of the company? How we talk about the company, everything, all the messaging should be there. The other thing I decided was that I learned that I really decided. So when I started working on this, my deliverable to the company would basically be a chart with those five elements defined. Like, okay, what is the change? This was, and that was based on what I had seen, like marketing consultants kind of do in my career. You know, they'd leave behind some. They might not do the same framework, but they'd leave behind, you know, some sort of messaging house. They would call it a messaging map, where it's like, okay, here's our top message. Here's the pillar messages. These fragments of messages, and I found in my career that would break down, and I found it in my own work because the idea was that people are going to go back to this thing and pull messages from it. And people didn't go back, especially when they were outside of marketing and it was kept in marketing. The other thing was, even if they did, I think it's very hard for most people to like string together these fragments into something compelling that's going to work. And so I thought really hard, like what would work better? And I came to the sales deck. This took a couple of years for me to learn, like the sales deck as the core strategic and narrative asset. And this is very controversial. Like, most people see the sales deck as an output of some, I don't know, fundamental strategic document thing that lives somewhere else. And I'm saying, no, let's make the sales deck, which is how we talk, let's make that the fundamental thing, and everything goes off that. And you know, still people have to kind of come back to it, but I think we have a much better shot because, hey, it's going to get used in the most important channel for the company all the time.
Yeah. So this framework essentially supersedes vision, mission, positioning, marketing, messaging. So if that's the case, and I guess that's the big challenge for you, isn't it? Because you're already coming into mature businesses where they have, you know, segmented teams, they have, you know, robust leadership with strong opinions. And then you're coming in and saying, well, we actually need something that supersedes all these things and interconnects all of them. That must be really challenging. So from like in an ideal world, when would you approach this? Is it based on what I've just said? Is it from day dot? You would define this from day one and everything supersedes, cascades down from that. Would that be the case?
Hey there, this is Alex, CRO lead at Upper Media, and I'm here to tell you that if you want to get more conversions for your SaaS business, you need to prioritize conversion rate optimization. At Upper Media, CRO is our specialty, and we can analyze your website, find areas of improvement, and set up a tailored optimization program to get you more conversions. Visit us at uppermedia.com/CRO to learn more.
I would say you're right. That is a hard sell. And it's probably why, like, you know, the majority of CEOs are not going to ever hire me, right? Like, they're going to delegate, they're going to have a mission vision statement, they're going to delegate this thing to marketing, whatever. There are some, though, there's some small set, big enough small subset for me to like sort of live where this resonates with them. And I think, like I said, there are certain points in the journey of the company where they'll resonate. And that was you asked about learnings. This was another huge learning for me, that there would be that this narrative thing became super critical at later stages of the company. When I was first starting, like I said, I got into this because I was pitching a startup that I had no money for initially. So once these screenwriting books kind of helped me, and actually, I don't know if I mentioned, like, we redid our plan and we sent it out again. And after a few months, we had a term sheet, and like it clearly helped us. And it helped me as a CEO, but I had no money like to pay a consultant. So for like 15 years, I wanted to kind of do this work, but I was like, well, there's going to be no money in it, you know? I mean, actually, I had an in-person class in San Francisco for a while that a lot of folks would come to, and I love it. You know, like, it was like $100. Like, I wasn't making money off it. I just really enjoy getting to interact with people at that stage. But what happened was, early on, I started working with a CEO of a Series C company, who contacted me through a CEO who knew me, who knew about my work, and he's saying, hey, listen, I need help with blah 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 blah, and it's basically he needs this narrative thing, and I didn't have the guts to like say like, hey, why don't you just hire me to do that, because that wasn't a thing. So I said, why don't you hire me to be like an interim CMO? And he did. This was a company called 500 Friends, which was a loyalty platform for e-commerce brands. And the CEO, Justin Yoshimura, after about 9 months, we worked together. The company got acquired by a really big marketing agency, and eventually by Dentsu Japan. And I asked Justin, like, was it worth hiring me? And he said yes. And he's a very straight shooter, so he would have said no. So I said, well, could you sum it up? And he's like, you got our story straight. And I said, well, if I had said just at the beginning, like, I'm going to get your story straight, and here's how much I'm going to charge you and equity, whatever, would you have done it? And he said yes. And this really surprised me. And I said, I don't believe you. And that was a YC company. He sent a note out to the YC founders list, Y Combinator founders list, and kind of said, hey, this is what he did. And a whole bunch of founders, one of the first was Spencer Skates of Amplitude, said, hey, we're looking for this. They were a little early on, but what I learned was that this was going to continue to be an issue. And I don't ever pitch it. I don't ever like try to convince anybody. What happens, I think, is CEOs get to this place where, hey, having the mission, having, you know, the vision, having the messaging doc, the category name, like, it's somehow not enough. And they're looking for something to tie it all together. And somehow what I said resonates with them.
Yeah. Just on the kind of the output, maybe some successful examples of, well, and a good example of a company that you've worked with. How has that kind of impacted them? What has been kind of the net positive after you've worked with them? What have they reported back to you?
A couple of the sort of really interesting ones. Gong was a really interesting one. So I worked with the Gong team. We did this work. They, you know, this whole idea about like the old game opinions, new game reality, I think they would agree, comes out of that work. When Amit Bendoff, the CEO, contacted me at first, he was like, listen, I mean, they were already like a Series B company. I think this was about 2018. He's like, look, Andy, we're going to be big. That's already kind of clear. What I don't know is how big. And I think that this narrative, if we get it right, will be a multiplier on our growth. How much of a multiplier was that? It's really hard to know. And, you know, I'm not going to take credit for that. I mean, this story, it's, you know, like that company made it the focus of everything they do. Like, you know, Amit told me once, like, it's not just our message to the world. It's also, you know, in marketing or sales, it's also the North Star for our product roadmap. Like, you know, we get requests for features all the time that basically turn out to be about recording opinions. And we're going to say no to all of them. Another, you know, more commonly, what I hear from the CEOs is, hey, we're getting everyone aligned around one voice, and that's letting us, you know, talk to people, in a more compelling way. I recently worked with a company called 360 Learning. So this is a training platform that's a corporate training platform that's really big. It's, they raised like $250 million, something like that. And for a while, they were talking about themselves as a collaborative learning platform. This was like their category name. But the CEO kind of comes to me and said, listen, you know, I'm talking about this. I say collaborative learning, but they're like, you know, it sort of like goes out, it comes in. We need a story to make it compelling. And so we came up with this story about, you know, the old world was learning in a corporation was like very top down, kind of like created by some learning manager or something. And in the new world, if you look at the winning companies, like who's winning, like Google and even Tesla, like they have this culture that's where like they create internal experts who train others. And and the idea is like you're gonna create this culture of learning internally. And so we came up with this buyer mission statement of upskill from within. And this again, like it's differentiating not by saying, hey, our platform is collaborative, but by saying, hey, there's a different goal state we want to put out there for you versus what every other training platform is talking about. And Nick Hernandez, who's the CEO, he tells me that now when he's frequently pitching CEO to CEO, like it's just like gold in terms of getting that CEO to then introduce to the learning team, which, you know, is the actual buyer.
Yeah. So obviously, a lot of people listening to this won't be able to afford someone like yourself, Andy. I've no clue how much you charge, but I'm guessing that's the case. And they'll probably want to, maybe think about this problem and maybe how they could potentially overcome it. If someone was to, you know, be inspired by, what we spoke about today, and they were thinking about, you know, how they could potentially address this problem. Would you have any advice for them? Is there kind of some place you can point them in terms of, I guess, obviously they can follow your own content, which is super useful, but is there anything else you can provide to those people that perhaps want to tackle this problem themselves?
I talk about almost every day on LinkedIn, I'm posting something that I learned in interactions with CEOs or teams around this work. I also collected the article that you mentioned and a bunch of others that cover various different facets of this stuff on Medium. So if you go to medium.com/@Raskin, that has all of those posts. It's kind of like a little tutorial on how to approach a bunch of the different aspects of this thing if you read them all together.
Gotcha. Thank you. Touch on this a little bit, just in terms of the alignment. I think it was your third, learning. I think you said alignment is really, really hard. And it sounds like just in the sense of having the CEO be the leader of this project in of itself, I'm sure is incredibly helpful for getting alignment. But once you've got those, I think four or five people in that room, and I'm sure there's a lot of debate and disagreement, healthy disagreement. How do you go about navigating that and getting everybody to a consensus? Do you have any tips on that?
So this is some secret sauce. Not that it's secret, but it's just like a lot to explain. But one thing, maybe I'll give you some sense of it. So when I started that company a long time ago, we ran into a place where like we were having a really hard time executing. And one of the VCs introduced me to a management consultant named Howard Goldman. And I introduced Howard to I talked to Howard, and Howard's whole approach was how to run a meeting so that you get the different opinions and you kind of come up with a decision and move forward. And it sounds like such a simple thing, but it was in a way more valuable than anything I learned in business school. When Howard told me this, I said, I think that can really help us. I told my co-founder, who's Japanese, his name is Zen, about it. Zen met Howard and was like, yeah, this is bullshit. But I overruled Zen and we brought in Howard, and he helped us so much and Zen became was so impressed. Zen eventually became like Howard's disciple and created this and went back to Japan and like created like the Howard multi-level marketing of consultants of meetings consultants. But I got a lot from Howard in terms of how to run a meeting. And I use a lot of that stuff. And some of the things are, I'll present the first piece of the strategic narrative, like the shift in the world, old game, new game. I'll show a bunch of examples, Gong, Zwora, Salesforce, I see as kind of the original one, like used to be software, now it's the cloud, that was a real archetypal version of this. And then I'll ask a question like, what is it for you? And for one thing I do is I have them write it down. So I have them write down, because free for all, like that just takes time and there's a lot of prejudices of who talks a lot. So write it down. I learned this from Howard. And then I go around the room and have everybody read it one by one. And everybody's really, one person gets the floor and everybody's really focused on them, which actually like better than like some people like post it on the wall or so, or post it in a group chat or a group doc. There's something about having the floor and having people listen to you feel heard, right? I do a bunch of rounds of this. And then the CEO, and when you can imagine, we come out with like boards and boards of notes and ideas. And then the CEO and I go off one-on-one together for like a week. And we create a first draft of this thing. And then we come back to the team and we say, hey, I have the CEO present it. And I ask them two questions, what's working and what's not working. And I also tell them ahead of time, like, this is going to be the low point. This second session where the CEO, this is going to be the low point of our work together. Because in that first session, you're going to be giving like gold ideas to the CEO, right? But there's going to be too many of them. So to come up with something sort of like clean and powerful or have a chance at being so, the CEO and I are going to have to throw out almost everything and you're going to be pissed. And it's funny, like, I just did a project. I just wrapped up one. I wrote about this on LinkedIn where this woman, she was a CFO and she was part of the team, part of this small team CFO is unusual, but in this case, it made a lot of sense because their product was a financial product. And she said, you know, you told us it was going to be a low point. Like, I love where we got to. You told us that second session was going to be a low point. Maybe you should have drilled it home a little bit more, you know, like, I was like, what could I have done? You know? But this airing of the complaints, like what's not working, and also, but also having some what's working so we can have a little bit of positivity. I also learned this from Howard, and then the CEO and I go back again. And usually when we come back, the team is starting to feel pretty good about where it is. So, and then there's still a lot of work to do, but my basic, in a nutshell, my approach to this alignment thing. And it's hard. I mean, there's always one person who I've learned is always, there's one person is the naysayer, who's like, often it's a co-founder. I don't know why. Well, I have some theories about why it is, who's not the CEO, but the, you know, and this naysayer I found plays a very important role. Like, they're sort of, you know, keeping it on track and making it sure it doesn't get too bullshitty. But at the same time, they're a real challenge around the alignment. I have a career coach. I write about her on LinkedIn, who's kind of like my part therapist for dealing with these situations, because they can get very, very emotional. Another learning that this work is incredibly emotional for people who are in it.
Okay, just for my own fun now, I have a couple of closing questions. What is you don't have to name the company, but is there one that's gone completely sideways, or one that, not gone completely sideways, but one that's been very heated and challenging that you've had to overcome?
Yeah, so the company that maybe because it's fresh in my mind, this one that I just recently worked at, where the CFO said, hey, I wish you could have drilled it in there. What actually happened was they were so disillusioned after that second session that the co-founder actually called a timeout to the whole engagement. He's like, you know what? I don't even know if we should be doing this. Maybe we're not at the right stage. Maybe, you know, all this stuff. And okay. And the CEO and I had some deep talks about this. And his conviction, though, was, you know, so we decided, let's take a hiatus. And we did a hiatus. This never happened before. And I was like, no way we recover from this. Because momentum is really, especially when you're in this like dark place, right? Like if that's, you know, going to be hard to recover. And the CEO went back to the team and they had a bunch of discussions. And what they came to was I don't know if it was the overruling the CT, the co-founder, or sort of, coming to consensus with that person, but that the fact that we had so much trouble getting to something clean and clear was like a symptom that they needed this work. So then we restarted it. And
what was the time period between this?
It was about 2 weeks. There was about a 2 week hiatus.
Yeah.
There had been plenty of times where there's a naysayer where, you know, we have to sort of wrangle the story, but never one where we had stopped. And when they came back, it actually was great, because now we're committed to coming to finding it, you know, and that happened relatively quickly. You know, sometimes we have to do an extra iteration if the team isn't quite there after that second one, but we didn't even have to do that. Like we got there really fast after that.
Yeah. Yeah. Good stuff. Well, thank you, Andy. My final question is a little bit more of a personal question. We were actually talking about it but when we were speaking before we started recording. But for want of a better phrase, you're a one-man band. You're a consultant, a highly valuable one that's doing really, really great work. But why is it you choose to do this solo? And why do you not try and make this into a bigger thing, a bigger practice? I don't know. Why do you keep it intentionally small?
Well, I do try to make it bigger. I do.
Okay, yeah, sure.
I wouldn't say that I'm not trying to make it bigger, but I'm trying to make it bigger through just doing more. Honestly, like I've raised my rate over the years. Since a decade ago, it's as I got more confident working with bigger and bigger companies, I charge less for smaller companies, but still. So I try to grow it, but that avenue of growing it through hiring people who are going to be, I'm going to manage to do the work. I didn't want to do that. At least I haven't yet. I might change my mind. But I really love doing the work. As I get older, I'm starting to think more about teaching more. I used to have, like I said, that class in San Francisco, but, that wasn't the COVID kind of nixed that. And now I'm thinking about, do I want to do that, maybe in a different way? I'm thinking about it.
That sounds really interesting on the teach. I mean, I guess it's a great, if you can create a training program, which is really high quality and it really does bring people up as close to your level as possible, then I guess that can ultimately create more impact for more companies and maybe be more meaningful for you. But maybe that's,
I just enjoy working with people on it. So I love doing that class. People were great. They really did get it.
Yeah. Well, listen, I'd be one of the first people to sign up to any training course. I personally found this, your work super interesting and inspiring. When I was researching this podcast, I felt like I connected the dots with a few companies, they've used your framework or a similar framework. I find it incredibly interesting, and not just for our own company, we're a small agency. I think, even our own pitch deck and the way we approach things, I think we can do a much better job. So yeah, thank you for the work you're doing. And, I think you already kind of mentioned where people can find you, but maybe you want to end up by, just reiterating, the best places, for people to follow.
Probably best places, just connect with me on LinkedIn and, follow me there. That's where I'm usually posting stuff. That's usually good.
Good stuff. And we'll also share the articles we mentioned here as well on the Medium in the show notes. So thanks so much, Andy. This was great. And hopefully speak soon. Thanks for tuning in, guys. I really hope you enjoyed today's episode. For links to any of the resources, or if you'd like to be a guest on the podcast, head over to uproarmedia.com.